This is Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio. I'm your host, Sean Garcia. On this episode, we discuss the legacy of Malcolm X as February 21st marks the 50th anniversary of his assassination at the Audubon Ballroom in New York City. But first, we have on Osenu Benga, organizer with the Democratic Union of Gambia Activists, who provides an introduction to Gambia's anti-colonial struggle, as well as the ongoing struggle against the dictator, Jammeh.
So this is Eugene Peryear with Liberation Radio, and we are very happy to be joined by Osenu Benga, who is an activist here and an organizer with DUGA, the Democratic Union of Gambian Activists. Os, great to have you here. Thanks for so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you, Eugene.
So I want to start because a lot of people in the U.S., I think, don't know a lot about Gambia, a small West African country. So I was hoping you could just say a little bit about the history of the country and, you know, some maybe colonialism as well.
Right. Thank you. Thank you again. Gambia, of course, a small country as it is known on the west coast of Africa, completely surrounded by Senegal, except on the coast, on the Atlantic Ocean, became independent or gained flag independence in 1965 and became a republic in 1971. And ever since, you know, has been struggling like most other neocolonial countries under a neocolonial economy. Early on, after flag independence, a lot of people were satisfied, you know, with how life was. But I mean, there were very challenging periods. I mean, and the vast majority of people even think that, you know, life was better then than it is now. And that says a lot about this social system that gave birth to what we will talk, who we will talk about later, Jammeh, this neo-colonial system that is colonialism in black faces. You know, so the educational system in the Gambia was very, colonial indeed, but then very enlightening. I mean, in that, you know, when I was growing up, you know, we were very eager to know about our history and the history of the world and Africa. So from 1965 to 1971, when it became a republic, from the 70s into the 80s, you know, we had our first tragic experience of coup d'etats. There was an attempted coup by a group of Gambians, you know, who were just disgruntled, you know, with the current system, and the coup did not, you know, succeed. Senegal intervened, you know, of course, at the behest of the British and the French colonialists, and repelled the coup. And after that experience, you would have thought that the government would have, you know, that would have been a wake-up call, and that the government would have, you know, at least understand that some things need to be really taken care of, but they never did, you know. And then there was a brief confederation, you know, between Senegal and Gambia, which was just a joke. From 1994, you know, Gambia went on a, you know, nosedive into misery, you know, and just upright wretchedness and poverty, you know, even in disagreement, you know, this guy, maybe later on we can, you know, elaborate more on this, you know, specificities, you know, but that's the state of the Gambia. A typical neo-colonial entity.
Yes, and I think since you bring it up, let's go straight there. The current president, Yahya Jammeh, could you explain something about, like, you know, how did he come to power and what is the character of Regime? You alluded to it a lot there, some of the things that he's doing. But if you could just give people more of a sense, more of a picture of his regime.
Right, right. You know, which is, you know, very good. Because we have to put in a historical context. Because Jammeh just didn't drop from the skies. A social system gave birth to him, which, you know, as I alluded earlier, was neo-colonialism, colonialism in black faces. There are a lot of them like him, you know, wreaking havoc in the continent right now. So 1994, here was a lieutenant, you know, like impoverished, you know, diseased, you know, in bad health, you know, who by sheer accident, you know, and sometimes, you know, I'm not sure whether we can call it an accident, but, you know, well, let's say that, you know, it was an accident that, you know, some of these other soldiers that got into this thing with him were stupid enough to let him take the, you know, like the upper echelon of the of power. So when he came into power, you know, like this, were the way it started was that some of the soldiers that went to Liberia, at that time Liberia was aflame, you know, and these reactionary, you know, wars, you know, that happened, proxy wars, you know, in the colonial states, you know, in Africa and elsewhere. So when they came back, because the government was at that time seriously, you know, like indebted and actually almost to a standstill. So the soldiers were complaining about being paid. The president was trying to resolve the problem by, you know, talking to some of the higher officers. But then, you know, these low officers, you know, were, you know, very adamant about, you know, making some fundamental changes, you know. So the Jawara had gone out of the country, and by sheer coincidence, as they claim, the USS Lamore County was in the waters of Gambia, with the Lamore County being in the Gambian waters, and then the soldiers very much disgruntled, wanted to, you know, really overthrow the government. So this is how this whole thing happened. And it's amazing. During this, you know, this so-called alleged coup, and at the beginning, you know, like many people didn't think that it was a coup. And they, you know, even the soldiers said that they just wanted to talk to the president, you know, and let him hear their grievance. And then, you know, and they'll go back to barracks. But then the U.S. ambassador, of all people, came in and told the president, that you know, like, look, let's go into the boat, you know, your life is under threat, you know, like getting him out of harm's way. So once he got into the boat, that was it. The soldiers had easy access. They came in, took over Banjul, you know, the capital, you know, and secured the airport and the barracks where most of the weapons were, you know, and most of the population, you know, without enough political understanding, jubilated, you know. But they didn't know exactly, you know, like what coup d'etat, you know, like really brings. Because coups are not revolutions. Even though they mischaracterized it as a revolution, the July 22nd revolution, you know, it wasn't anything close to anything revolutionary. Because we know a lot of other close continents, like in Latin America, you know, in other places, you know, where the U.S., you know, like outright, you know, like, or very subtly supported, you know, like these regime change, you know, in sometimes really violent and bloody coup d'etats. And, you know, Jammeh and his sycophants always, but now they have stopped saying that. They used to say that, you know, it was a bloodless coup. But there is no such thing as a bloodless coup, you know. Everywhere it happened, in any neo-colonial state, there's always violence. They started killing each other, the soldiers. And then what is most interesting, Eugene, is that they had this really impotent, you know, so-called intellectual class. And it happened in Liberia. When Samuel Doe came into power, they gathered all the so-called intellectuals, you know, around them, you know, to wield power. So this time they were crawling, and these so-called pseudo-intellectuals, you know, a lot of them, you know, supported them, even lawyers, people, you know, who had degrees. The only thing they could do was just show, you know, like those certificates. But they couldn't produce anything to change the conditions of living in the country. You know, they will only perform well, you know, when they are hired by IMF, you know, the International Maldevelopment Fund. That's all they call it, monetary fund. But all it does is maldevelop Africa. You know, so all of these guys surrounded these soldiers and helped them. you know, really, you know, established and wielded power. And when they saw what was in there, they started, you know, eliminating them one after the other. You know, so this is what Jammeh has become. You know, this guy has really emasculated, you know, chief justices, you know me, the so-called intellectuals, you know, like in different, you know, fields. So this is what, you know, Gambia has become ever since the 1994 coup. What we need now, you know, like, is to really make serious revolution, you know, in the Gambia and elsewhere to overturn this relationship that we have, you know, with the with these neo-colonial tyrants, you know, that are just wreaking havoc on Africa and African people.
Well, and the I guess the maybe not silver lining of that situation, but one of the important things for people to know is that there is a lot of organizing going on and emanating, of course, from the Gambian diaspora community, but drawing in, you guys have done a great job of drawing in folks from around the country. So if you could just say a little bit about some of the organizing you're doing here in the United States and also elsewhere.
Yes, you know, yeah, particularly here in the U.S., because we came into existence, DUGA, the Democratic Union of Gambian Activists, in 2012. Yes, 2012, when he just woke up one morning and decided that he was going to execute the people who were on death row. So after the executions, you know, we thought that, you know, like, it was very important to really begin resist this, you know, oppressive regime in the Gambia within an organized structure. So we came up with DUGA, the Democratic Union of Gambian Activists. And since then, you know, we've been, you know, really trying to organize the community in here. And, you know, it's been a challenge, of course, but that's why it's called a struggle. And we've been successful in some instances of having branches, you know, like in different parts of the U.S., you know, like Minnesota, you know, New York, Atlanta. And we, you know, had one in, you know, a representative, you know, like in Sweden, you know. And so what we're trying to do, you know, is really spread and make it a very, you know, widespread or international organization. So we led demonstrations, you know, against the Jammeh whenever he comes in here at his residence, you know, in the Potomac, at the UN. Just any time that he comes in here, we have already made the declaration that since, you know, you're just pestering the lives of, you know, Gambians, you know, on the ground there, you know, anytime you come to the US, you know, be rest assured that, you know, you will have sleepless nights. So wherever he goes, you know, we're always out there to, you know, just show and expose, you know, his reactionary tendencies, you know, to the rest of the world. And in 2013, you might have remember when we went to the embassy, you know, and took over the embassy briefly and refused to leave. And, you know, myself, Coach Basamba, and Sohna were arrested, you know. And these were just ways of, you know, really making the people understand that, you know, power lies in our hands. Last year, when the Africa, U.S. Africa summit happened here, you know, and you had all these tales of states, 54 of them came in here, you know, all of them, you know, just vying to take pictures with Obama, you know, and ask if that was what is going to be the solving the solution to our problem, you know. And on the second day when we went out there, and, you know, I think they have had enough of us, you know, his thugs came out and attacked us. You know, like, is, you know, like, we are determined and uncompromisingly, we have no apologies for everything that we have done so far. And in fact, you know, we have declared 2015 to be the most radical year for us. That, you know, we want to radicalize the entire Gambian community here in the U.S. and, you know, even back home, to just show him that, you know, like, he's not untouchable. You know, he thinks that he's invincible. You know, like, the tragic December 30th, 2014 incident. It's very, you know, it's very tragic that, you know, these three brothers, you know, were just, you know, killed like that, you know. But, you know, as you know, there's a saying, you know, in the African community here that a setback is nothing but a setup for a comeback. And, you know, yeah, there's going to be a comeback constantly, you know, and Jammeh has to go. That is our final declaration that he has to go. 20 years is too damn long for have to have put up with the Jammeh regime, and he hasn't done anything for Gambia or Africa, but just creating more mayhem, you know, and confusion, you know. Electric agriculture. He has paralyzed agriculture completely in the Gambia.
And you can find continued coverage on the struggles going on in Gambia by going to liberationnews.org. You're tuned in to Liberation Radio, and you can check out our website, liberationradio.org, on Facebook at facebook.com/Liberation Radio Show, and on Twitter at the handle Liberation Radio. Next on Liberation Radio, we have on Eugene Puryear, author of Shackled and Chained and member of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. This weekend marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X. Eugene, 50 years later, what should our main takeaway be about Malcolm X?
Well, I think that at this stage in the game, our main takeaway has to be that Malcolm X, Elhaj Malik Abdul Shabazz, was a revolutionary. I think that his legacy, certainly there's a lot to take in there. I think certainly in his final years, he was exploring and doing a whole range of different things. But at the end of the day, if you look at what was most significant, is that not only was Malcolm X looking outside of the system, in particular towards the end of his life, for the solution to the problem of national oppression or, you know, that's essentially racism in our society, and was 100% really the clarion voice, the clearest voice against those who were seeking accommodation with the system in a way that compromised the Black liberation movement. And so I think that whatever else we may see, it's clear from his statements, his attitude, and really just the whole sweep of his work, that the key takeaway, and I titled an article this once, is it's not complicated. Malcolm X was a revolutionary.
And last year, Manning Marable wrote a book about Malcolm that I'm sure many people will be buying. What do you think of that book?
Well, you know, and the article I just mentioned, the It's Not Complicated, Malcolm X is a Revolutionary, was a response to that book. I mean, I think short story here, the late Manning Marable's book is essentially an attempt to pigeonhole Malcolm X in a way that makes his ideas, it really shears his ideas of all of their revolutionary essence and tries to fit him into a framework that will be acceptable to the liberal left wing of the Democratic Party type of milieu, particularly amongst white people who may have some fear of Malcolm X. And it essentially takes away key elements of his legacy to serve what was Dr. Marable's own political agenda. And I was happy that my essay appeared in a book that I think people absolutely need to buy in conjunction with Marable's book if they're going to buy it. And certainly there is some useful information there. It's called A Lie of Reinvention from Black Classic Press, edited by Jared Ball, Dr. Jared Ball, who people who listen to this show will be aware of, as well as Todd Burrows. And so I think ultimately that's a collection of essays from other Black scholars discussing Marable's book and really coming with the same conclusion that it was it had a political agenda to try to whitewash Malcolm X. I mean, as we see with so many of the greatest revolutionary figures, once they die, everyone tries to make them uncontroversial. And this was a book-length attempt to do that with Malcolm X. And I think unfortunate, but nevertheless, it's out there. And I think people should read it. I mean, I think there is interesting information, but, you know, read it with a grain of salt and read it with a lie of reinvention right next to you.
This is also a big year of anniversaries for the civil rights movement. How do you think we need to modify or even abandon the whole Malcolm Martin dichotomy?
Well, I think we have to completely abandon it. I mean, the whole Malcolm Martin thing is really a created thing. I mean, even the tensions that they had in their life were starting to fade towards the end as Malcolm X absolutely was trying to build bridges towards Martin Luther King and others in the civil rights movement, even if they didn't see eye to eye on all issues. He was working with people who might fall into what would be called a quote-unquote integrationist camp or quote-unquote civil rights camp, like Gloria Richardson, who led the militant struggle in Cambridge, Maryland against segregation that, you know, even involved bombings and shootings and all sorts of things, armed self-defense from Blacks and vigilante violence from whites. And Gloria Richardson, one of the most militant leaders, was closely affiliated with Malcolm X, but also a member of the quote-unquote civil rights movement and also fighting Jim Crow for quote-unquote integration. So I say all that with all the exaggerated air quotes there because so many of these terms and phrases have been used and created by journalists, academics, political activists with their own agenda, and that at the end of the day, even when certain individuals may not have agreed on all points, there is a basic unity in the Black liberation movement, a freedom movement, a movement to overthrow and uproot the national oppression that continues to plague us, and that ultimately Malcolm X and Martin Luther King both made, you know, very important context, very important contributions in the context of their particular strategies. And so thinking about Malcolm versus Martin isn't true to those men, nor is it true to the reality of that civil rights movement, where, quite frankly, there was a permeable membrane between the two. Clarence Jones, who was one of Martin Luther King's lawyers in New York, very close to King, also very close to Malcolm X. So we see these sort of permeable things happening between the two, permeable membrane between a lot of these different camps that I think the differences between have been a little bit exaggerated, maybe not too much, but certainly a little too much is made of this whole Malcolm versus Martin, violence versus nonviolence, nationalist versus integrationist. I mean, all of those are terms that are loaded, and I think from the point of view of our historiography, we must stand it.
And so, you know, with the 50th anniversary rolling around, what lessons can we learn today from the legacy of Malcolm X?
Well, I think the lesson we have to learn from the legacy of Malcolm X more than anything is his unceasing struggle for freedom. I mean, he continued to fight through so many different obstacles, threats to his own life in a disciplined way. And also, I would say, the intellectual rigor that backed it. I mean, you know, one little interesting tidbit, since I just sort of ripped Manning Marable there, one little interesting tidbit from his book is Malcolm, to relax now, would go to the New York City Public Library to read Hegel. And anyone who's ever delved into Hegel and, you know, think that anyone would read it for fun will show you the intellectual depth of the man that thought that was like the thing to do for entertainment. So, you know, at the end of the day, not only was he dedicated, not only was he organizing, not only was he fighting every day, but he also took a strong interest and desire in gaining every piece of knowledge possible and finding ways to integrate that knowledge into a liberatory framework, and or really constructing a liberatory framework out of that knowledge. And I think that's a fantastic legacy that we should continue to push forward on.
Right on. Long live Malcolm X. Thanks a lot, Eugene.
No, thank you so much.
22 million black victims of Americanism are waking up, and they're gaining a new political consciousness, becoming politically mature. And as they become, develop this political maturity, they're able to see the recent trends in these political elections. They see that the whites are so evenly divided that every time they vote, the race is so close, they have to go back and count the votes all over again. And which means that any block, any minority that has a block of votes that stick together is in a strategic position. Either way you go, that's who gets it. You're in a position to determine who'll go to the White House and who'll stay in the doghouse. You're the one who has that power. You can keep Johnson in Washington, D.C., or you can send him back to his Texas cotton patch. You're the one who sent Kennedy to Washington. You're the one who put the present Democratic administration in Washington, D.C. The whites were evenly divided. It was the fact that you threw 80% of your votes behind the Democrats that put the Democrats in the White House. When you see this, you can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years. And all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first, and they put you last. Because you're a chump. A political chump. In Washington, D.C., in the House of Representatives, there are 257 who are Democrats. Only 177 are Republican. In the Senate, there are 67 Democrats. Only 33 are Republicans. The party that you bash controls two-thirds of the House of Representatives and the Senate, and still they can't keep their promise to you, because you're a chump. Anytime you throw your weight behind a political party that controls two-thirds of the government, and that party can't keep the promise that it made to you during election time, and you are dumb enough to walk around continuing to identify yourself with that party, you're not only a chump, but you're a traitor to your race. And what kind of alibi do they come up with? They try and pass the buck to the Dixiecrats. Now, back during the days when you were blind, deaf, and dumb, ignorant, politically immature, naturally you went along with that. But today, as your eyes come open and you develop political maturity, you're able to see and think for yourself. And you can see that a Dixiecrat is nothing but a Democrat in disguise. You look at the structure of the government that controls this country. It's controlled by 16 senatorial committees and 20 congressional committees. Of the 16 senatorial committees that run the government, 10 of them are in the hands of Southern segregationists. Of the 20 congressional committees that run the government, 12 of them are in the hands of Southern segregationists. And they're going to tell you and me that the South lost the war.
That's all for Liberation Radio. I'm Sean Garcia. Please remember this program is available free for broadcast by community and public radio stations. You can encourage your local radio station to air Liberation Radio. They can visit liberationradio.org for details. Tune in next week for more from the struggle for justice.
You have been listening to Liberation Radio, a weekly program from the Party for Socialism and Liberation. You can find us online at liberationradio.org to listen to past shows and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Some of what you heard during this program are Creative Commons licensed compositions. Our theme music and some music segments were performed by Six Fingers and used with permission of the artist. Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation to help build the struggle for socialism in the United States. The PSL is a party of activists and organizers. We are in the streets at the demonstrations and picket lines, opposing cutbacks and attacks on workers, standing up to police brutality, fighting for immigrant rights, and struggling against racism, sexism, homophobia, and all forms of bigotry. We stand in solidarity with oppressed peoples around the world resisting imperialism. We believe the crimes of capitalism call for a new kind of society, and we are committed to fighting for it. To find a PSL branch near you, see our upcoming events and learn more about how you can get involved. PSLweb.org. Again, that's PSLweb.org. Also, the PSL's Liberation newspaper online at liberationnews.org, where you can read our news articles and analysis or purchase a subscription to the print edition. Thank you for listening.